Hey, wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 328 of the JV Club with my boy of summer, John C. McGinley. You may know him from Stand Against Evil, which is the show I had the very, very great pleasure of working with John on. Many of you are probably Scrubs fans. He's also had just an extraordinary career in film and theater. I welcome you in to enjoy this episode with him. We cover a lot of ground. And I wanted to just give a quick shout out to the Global Down Syndrome Foundation. It is readily accessible online if you give it a Google, or if you would like, I believe we have a link to it in the show notes. I hope everyone's doing great and having a kick butt summer. And I will talk to you next time. Oh, you know what? I wanted to give, this is so exciting. Ooh, to just throw a quick shout out there. I wanted to remember to give Nick a shout out for your wonderful email. All right, everybody. I will talk to you soon. Enjoy the ep. This is the first time you and I have seen each other since our show ended. We both have verified that we were in a deep, deep denial and had a bunch of other stuff going on. So we had to have a quick recap of it being a criminal shame that we don't get to do Stand Against Evil anymore.
We would, in fact, be in Georgia right now.
We would.
Knee deep in the first four episodes.
Yeah, we would be.
So
It was weird to be in town and be aware of that.
I had convinced myself because of how good the third season was, how well it was written on the page and how astonishing the ensemble was and the style of the piece and the guest stars who came in, and the way it came together in post and the platform that IFC gave it. I thought we were going to do four or five more years.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a little delusional, but I have been on shows that do four or five more years, and the sophistication level of this comedy and the way Dana was rendering it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Obviously, it didn't meet the numbers that IFC was looking for, and then when that happened, I then convinced myself that somebody else was going to come in and swoop this thing up and just steal it.
Yeah.
Going into the column of, oh my God, IFC doesn't want this. We'll take it in a second.
Yeah.
And it was crickets.
Yeah.
There was nothing.
Yeah.
And so it didn't hurt my feelings as much as it really made me sad.
Yeah.
Because I know we poured everything into that third season.
Yeah.
Dana wrote some unbelievably emotional roller coaster, some opportunities for you and I to really dig into stuff that's preposterously ambitious.
Yeah.
On a 22-minute horror comedy. Dana put all this emotional underpinning in it, and everybody just sank their teeth into it, and it elevated the whole piece. And I thought, sure shooting, we are really on to something. This is going to be a great, at least 5-year run.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't. And showbiz is rough, man. Showbiz is a bitch.
Yeah. Was it hard going to, I don't mean to malign any production that has come before or since, but was it hard going from a show that was so much kind of flowing through your veins, being part of the editing process and, you know, the scripting process and all of that, to kind of coming into someone else's show and doing a little time? Or was that more of a soft landing? Because it was like, well, there's a world outside of Stan. It exists. I'm going to do this other show, do an arc on it. It'll be fun, you know, but I won't have the...
It
won't weigh on me. Yeah.
It was more of the latter.
Yeah.
Because my friend and classmate, Eric LaSalle, who's the executive producer now of Chicago PD, had called the last 3 years, but for all the right reasons, I couldn't go join them because you and I were trying to push this boulder uphill.
Uh-huh.
All the press we were doing and all this stuff, which is fantastic. It was a treat, but then it became clear that I thought, wow, we have pushed the boulder uphill. The third season is great.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah.
And so I said, sure, I'll come to Chicago. And Eric's sets are, I mean, we spent every waking second of our lives together at NYU grad, 84, 83, and 82. And so I knew what Herrick's sets were going to be like. Mm. And I wasn't going to have to do any of the heavy lifting. That was all on Eric. And he set it up that, look, when you have a guest star come into an ensemble season six of a 1 hour where they're doing 22 to 24 a year, the writers are toast.
I'm sure.
I just remember that writers room on Scrubs, season six, they're toast. Everybody's had their affairs together. you know, the characters.
Yeah.
Every in the cops have all had chemical problems. They've all slept with everyone in the precinct.
Right.
They've done illegal things. They've done, so they're done.
You've explored every trope. You've explored the small world of, little. Yeah.
And so when you bring on, they saved this wildly eccentric, ambitious, crazed character. And I told Eric, I said, just don't write him don't look for any redemptions. Let's just write this guy, just a Machiavellian, ambition-driven monster. And the writers are like, we're salivating.
Oh, God, I bet. To bring something in from the outside that's just like a whole new vibe.
And so I was there for, from right before the Malibu fires till about a month ago. And so it was more, as you were suggesting, more of a soft landing.
Yeah, except for the Malibu fires part where you were like, holy shit, my family is in Malibu and I'm not there in this moment.
Watching 800 structures burn from 2,000 miles away is the stuff that madness is made of. Because for those of us who are control freaks, there was no control in that.
Yeah.
And by Sunday, I was with a friend of mine, Chris Chelios, watching the fire on a computer news feed of Channel 5. And it was like, it's a better than even chance. Your house is gone.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get any reports, and there was nobody there, and it was a mandatory evacuation, and that was intense, really intense. And I'm a total shut-in. I don't leave the house. And so everybody's like, well, if the house burns down, at least you have your health. And I'm like, oh, stop.
Do we have to do that right now?
Do we have to do that right now?
Yeah. Let's not look forward as if it's already happened and now I have to be somehow peaceful about it already.
Yes.
And it hasn't even happened yet. And I'm already supposed to be like, you know what? I'm
100%.
Chill. I have my health.
And so the house did not burn. And that's a long-winded way of saying the Chicago PD gig was miraculous.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
Yeah.
And it gave me something to obsess over other than the fact that Stan wasn't coming in. I must tell you, up until, I guess, the beginning of the year, I thought the phone was going to ring.
I know.
I did.
I know. I did too.
I've done 100 movies and 500 episodes of television. And all of a sudden, I was just like this naive jackass. And I was just like, no, someone's picking us up.
Yeah. I know, but it's so funny, too, because it really is usually the opposite. Because so many of us are so conditioned to have things pulled out from under us. But if you have a good run, and doing three seasons was a great run. You know, I mean, it's in terms of, like, better have
normal.
To have done it than not. But, yeah, to sort of come from a show like Scrubs and doing so much other work outside of television as well, You had as much reason to believe that it would have a longer lifespan as you did that it wouldn't from a personal level.
I also allowed myself uncharacteristically to completely fall in love with all you guys and the show and Dana and Frank. And I'm usually a much tougher date than that. And
yeah.
Because I know it's not going to work out.
Yeah.
I just know it's not.
Yeah.
And so you want to put on all that iron and all that armor. And I was naked, man. I was completely in love with all you guys, the whole ensemble, every person on the crew.
Yeah.
And I wasn't prepared this time.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question that is going to go there politically, so feel free to say I don't feel like talking about this, or we can
think about it.
But yeah, but how are you feeling about the sort of the boycott Georgia? The whole kind of like, look at all these actors and people who have vowed not to work in the state until the laws off the books. Obviously, it hasn't been enacted yet, but that's a sticky, especially sticky for people like you and me who have, like as you were saying, of course, this is why I thought of it, these wonderful people there who we know voted against the bill, who you're sort of going, are those the first, those are the first people who are going to feel it. If we say, fuck you, Atlanta,
then the first, jobs disappear.
The people on the front lines are the liberal people who are trying to turn that into a blue state. And I really struggled with the idea of just going, yeah, we're just going to pull the plug on all of those people who, some of whom moved there to be able to make a living and do it, you know?
Well, I don't want to tell anybody, any woman or man, what to do with their bodies or their birthing process. I know in the special needs community, it's very, very pro-life, and I respect that. I've always been a choice, and so I kind of had to walk a tightrope on this one.
Yeah.
Since I do spend so much time with people who are are adamantly pro-life, and that's why they had the child,
right,
who they already knew had special needs.
Right.
And so it's a tricky balancing act, but as far as Georgia goes, I don't know what Dana and I would have done.
Yeah.
And Frank, because at some point or another, since politicians aren't being held accountable from your president on, at some point these people have to be held accountable for these decisions that are preposterous.
Yeah.
And so The spineless answer to your question is I'm not sure. I wasn't put in a position.
I feel this. Yeah,
as a producer of a show that employs about 125 people, what we were going to do. I would love to have been. I would love to have had that conundrum, but we didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't give you a great answer, but I don't know.
No, that's a real answer. I definitely was not asking it because I felt like there was going to be, because I don't have one either. That's kind of why I wanted to run it by you and see sort of how you were feeling. And I hadn't thought about the tie-in with a special needs community. And of course, that makes perfect sense. I guess we should explain why you have those ties. I think most people who follow you and are fans of you know.
My son Max McGinley, who was born 21 years ago, and is doing fantastic.
I think of him as musician Max myself.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Double M, Eminem.
Max was born with Down syndrome, and I have become a fanatical advocate of trying to help those who can't help themselves. And so Maxie has opened that window to me. And it's pretty much become my priority in front of work, since work kind of takes care of itself, but the special needs community does not. And so I serve on the board of the Global Down Syndrome Foundation in Denver, Colorado, which is a science-driven charity that it's not a kumbaya, let's pass out pamphlets version of a special needs charity. The Global Down Syndrome Foundation built a wing at Denver Children's that only serves people with Down syndrome. And we chair all these scientists who are studying Alzheimer's, because if you're born with Down syndrome and you do live long enough, you will get Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And so our focus is on Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
Or Alzheimer's-like conditions will present. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
You won't get hard, fatty tumors for some reason, but you will get, you can get blood cancer, but you will not get hard, fatty tumors, but you will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, because the boomers are about to experience an avalanche of Alzheimer's, and nobody knows what it is except for brain plaque, but they don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
And so our community has become this very valuable little petri dish of research, and so we've leveraged federal research dollars against that. And so all of a sudden, the Down syndrome community is serving the boomers who have an Alzheimer's epidemic coming their way there's no infrastructure in place for it. In fact, nobody knows what it is.
Yeah.
And so that's where our focus is.
God, thank God. I mean, it really, well, and I, as you know, Brandon, my fiance, I don't ever know what to call him. I hate the in between of fiance. So I sometimes I just call him my husband because it feels easier.
It's easier.
But his brother has Fragile X, which we've talked about in the past, which is, of course, not Down syndrome, but has some similarities to the inheritability, you know, the sort of genetics of the development in the womb, all those kinds of things. They're cousins. And there is research being done with the correlation of dementia and Fragile X as well, because uh-huh. there are these similarities in the way the brain fires or comprehends or the protein. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I follow that. I'm very interested in that as well, because anytime you have something that is specialized that can, I don't want to say to kill two birds with one stone, but that when you have two things that are closely related in that way, sometimes it is the smaller group that says, well, we're prioritizing this. You guys are just flinging theories wildly because it is this sort of epidemic. But if you have something specific and you can come at it from a specific direction, thank God. You know what I mean? Because I do feel like that's where the real information and the breakthroughs are going to come.
I think the whole community is hoping that.
Yeah.
That the Fragile X and the people whose 21st chromosome tripled and that they'll yield some dividends there. And so we've been able to leverage federal research dollars for that.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
This is NASA. I see a flat Earth, but we should lie to everybody about it and say it's round. 10-4.
Maximum Fun brings you the latest podcast, an expose on the flat Earth.
I want to take advantage of humankind and make them believe a lie so that they will trust us, the government.
It's all an elaborate lie. And when you get on a plane, they purposefully fly you farther than you need to go.
It's disgusting. It needs to be stopped. And if you listen to Ono, Ross, and Carrie, we will tell you the truth behind the lies.
Just kidding.
No, we won't do that. We will just tell you the truth behind the truth, because what we do is we look at extraordinary claims.
That's right. We've gone undercover with alternative medical treatments, fringe religious groups, fringe science claims, the spiritual, paranormal. We're there to check it out and let you know what happens.
Is the Queen Mary haunted? I don't know. Find out.
We show up. We make friends. We learn what happens when you ask questions, and we tell you all about it.
And we get all that funky stuff done to us.
It's Ono, Ross, and Carrie
at MaximumFun.org.
This is the most cliche sort of like TV interview. We don't know each other. I'm just asking you vague questions. Someone else asked me to. But I do think that it's worth asking, because I do think that it is something that I know you run across every day, which is sort of, what do you feel like these sort of common misconceptions are that people have about Down syndrome, that they don't, if they don't have someone they care about in their family, if they've not interacted with someone with Down syndrome, what do you feel like needs to be brought to the table to them that they're just not seeing, or they, you know, maybe it's not their fault that they don't understand, but it's a misconception.
I find that a lot of people a lot of the people who are born with Down syndrome have a cognitive awareness that people don't understand. So that Max has a verbal challenges, communication challenges, he understands absolutely everything that he's hearing, which can be very maddening and frustrating, I'm sure for him and definitely for us. But I would say that's the number one, that when people refer to they as the community with special needs or challenges, and people with Down syndrome wear it right on their face with the distinctive different markers we mm-hmm. have, that they, the people take liberties about addressing they and conversing about they in their presence.
Oh,
and it's really rude.
Right.
And hurtful. And I always just... The corollary is a person with cancer. Would you talk about this person with cancer the same way you're talking about this person with challenges?
Yeah.
No, you never would.
Of course not. Yeah.
And so that's the number one, that our community can understand absolutely everything they're hearing.
Yeah. In terms of the fierceness, which I admire so much and I just love and embrace about your dedication to that organization and to the sort of cause at large, have you been always a person who was able to kind of ignite that fierceness in you, whether it was for obviously this perhaps being the most worthwhile part of your life or cause, but did you kind of grow up as a person with strong opinions and a person who was assertive about kind of communicating those opinions and so forth?
I guess the more germane to what I've arrived at is that having been a person who was never bullied because I wasn't a good target, just being a jock and being pretty physically capable, which is not what a bully wants to feast on.
Right, right.
I've seen bullies and I've put them down. And so I'm impacted by people who are insensitive to the special needs community as having a component of bullying in them. So in other words, people use the R word, which for us is retard and retarded,
right.
Even after they've been told that's really offensive and you would never say that about the Jewish community or use epithets about the African American community or the gay and lesbian community, because there's a consequence, there's a tax,
right.
There's a TAX on that kind of language. And then with our community, there's not, because you've picked the perfect target of cowardice to exercise your vitriol, because you won't get any blowback, because that's not what our group does. We're trying to make it through the day. That's it.
Mm.
Caregivers and our population are trying to get through today. And so when they're impacted by this divisive language, which is hurtful at all times, and so what I always ask people is, isn't there a better way to say that? And then the question is, well, what? And the answer is, well, when you said that you're acting like a retard, you were careful not to say you were acting like an N-word. Because if you said that, there damn sure would have been a consequence.
Sure, sure.
And then the person says, well, I didn't know. I'm like, well, now you do. And so maybe armed with that, maybe there's a better way to say it.
Right.
That you are acting, because it's never a compliment to use the R word, ever. It's always a put down.
Right.
And so that's my approach. Since you're allowed to talk any way you want, and I can't change the way you talk, but I can invite you to maybe find a better way to express yourself.
Yeah.
And so I teach it every once in a while. I teach seminars at UCLA and at USC with screenwriters, and that's kind of the in. Is there a better way to break this joke than with the R word?
Were there special needs kids in your high school? I'm going to go back to your teenage self for a second so we can dig into that a little.
Yeah. Max, when Max came along 21 years ago, it was a cosmic hammer to my skull. And so, no, it was very disorienting. Excuse me. I had no reference to go back to. Zero. And so you stick your head in the sand for a year or two trying to figure it out. And the first year or two, there's kind of a triple threat to people born with Down syndrome. You can have cerebral challenges, which present with seizures, seizure disorder. You can have different heart issues, and then you can have digestive. Some people get all three. Some people get one. Some people get two. Maxie got the seizure disorder, and so you're trying to make it through the day.
Yeah.
And then those abate, hopefully. Some of our people, it doesn't. And then you start looking for what are we supposed to do with this kid?
Yeah.
And then you start getting impacted by bullying and all that. But what I always tell everybody, every family, when I'm in these different family circles, is that every family has challenges. And whenever they purport to not, you can pretty much start your stopwatch.
Yeah.
I mean, ask Dylan Klebold's family before he shot up Columbine. He was a nice little boy. Families have challenges. And if you're lucky enough to have a kid born with Down syndrome, you hit the jackpot. And so, and the number one reason, and I've shared this many times with a lot of different families, is that most of us are going to go through life and be serviceable to good at things. Our job will figure out how to be good or serviceable at our job, and we'll get through the week, and then we'll do something for the weekend, and then we'll go back to our job, and we'll be okay at our job. When you're a parent of a kid with Down syndrome, you're going to have to be great at something. So it's an invitation to be great at some thing in your life, because you're going to have to overcompensate, and you're going to have to go to the speech therapist and the occupational therapist, and you're going to have to get in the car and drive this child everywhere. And the child might be with you for the next 50 years, God willing, 60 years. And so you're going to have to be a great parent, but you get to have a shot at being great at something. You were okay in high school. You made it through college. Now you got a job. You're making your 120 grand a year. It's a good. Everything's going great. You're good at stuff. But you've never been great at anything.
Hmm.
You get a chance to be great at something.
Yeah.
That's a gift.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a burden. I think it's a gift. It's an invitation to be great.
I love that. That's fantastic.
It's true.
When you said 50 years, 60 years, have life expectancies increased over time? And if so, how so? What's being done to preserve the lifespan?
Number one is early interventions. In other words, the most basic one is that every child's formula that's ever been made has increased iron in it. Well, iron is poison to our community. And so parents find that out. And so now all of a sudden, all your organs are being protected because you're not being bombed with iron from the formula you're giving the child for the first, I don't know how long you get formula, year and a half, 2 years of your life. And that's just rudimentary. But all the early interventions are having our kids live much longer. I don't know what the number is, 60, 65?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't
the double,
come at
of course,
you
the double-edged
these...
sword is, if you live to 65, you have Alzheimer's.
Boy, so. Congratulations, everybody.
Yay. So we're not there.
It's not easy.
And so, yeah, but it's not easy for every family.
True.
And so I'm always careful not to do the too much of woe is me on kids born with Down syndrome. And because it's been a gift. Max has been a gift for us. Biggest gift in the history of the planet.
Do you come from a big family?
Yes. It's three boys and two girls.
Three boys and two girls. Irish, may I?
Yeah, and we were the table at the neighborhood where everybody was allowed to have a friend. So there's usually 10 kids at our table.
Yeah. That's the opposite of how I grew up.
New York, Jersey. By the time we got to Jersey, if you, my sister Janet, were allowed to bring Beth, well, then I was bringing Steve.
Right.
And Mark was bringing Bob. And Jerry was bringing Biff. And now all of a sudden, there's 10 of us at this table.
Yeah.
My mother did the most genius thing. She was a school teacher. She's still alive, but she was a school teacher for about 25 years. And we had this big circular pine table, about 8 feet in circumference. And in the middle was a Lazy Susan. Do you know what a Lazy Susan is? It's a top that...
spinner around, yeah.
And so she would let you, my sister Janet, and your friend, everybody would line up in the kitchen, and you'd serve yourself a hot dog and some beans and maybe some lettuce. And then you'd come and you'd sit down. And everybody else would come and sit down. And because there were too many people here, there was usually about two hot dogs left.
Uh-huh.
And so you'd have to sit down. And the two rules my mother had at that table were... you could touch that Lazy Susan for those two more hot dogs when you did two things. You had to be able to see the enamel on that plate. And you had to tell a story and contribute to the meal.
Really?
Yes.
That's awesome.
It's great. And
that's
it's
fantastic.
Interesting because the arc, at least for little boys, of not caring and telling a story to when testosterone starts being introduced, when we're just petulant little... monsters. Uh-huh. And we're like, I'm not telling a story.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even like anybody here.
But also, I'm hungry all the time.
Yeah, but I'm hungry. So you look at a hot dog and you go touch that thing. And my mother and father had this thing where they'd flip the other side of a spoon over. And so they'd be holding the spoon and then the handle, they'd whack you on the wrist.
Uh-huh.
And if you've ever been whacked on the wrist with a spoon handle, it hurts so much, it's disorienting.
Oh, God.
And my mother, for some reason, I don't know why to this day, she was just a regular Irish woman in dimension, that is. She had octopus arms. She could reach across the table and hit a wrist.
She had to have some kind of superpower with all those people roaming around
no
in there.
No question.
Yeah.
But the woman somehow was able to strike a blow from 10 feet. And so if your wrist got hit a couple of times, you never touched that Lazy Susan until the plate was clear and you told a story. I rode my bike to school today and I didn't hit a crack, so I never broke my mother's back.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Boom. Stuff in the face.
And so, but what my takeaway from that wasn't the clearing your plate as much as what I do with my kids is you have to tell us your roses and your thorns, what happened today. And you can, if you had no thorns, great. If you had no roses, you have to tell us at least something that happened today.
Yeah.
And people largely want to share what happened, and especially at dinner. Because when the kids go away at 8 or 7:30 and then they don't get back, you know, with all the different pottery and ballet and aerial and all the stuff they have, now it's 7:30. I want to know what you did today.
Yeah.
And I could care less if you're in a bad mood.
Yeah.
And so I'll sit. Well, wait. Even Max, I make Max tell us three things. And so he'll say, he works at Starbucks. He'll say, Starbucks, band, beach. And I'm like, no. So we use a trigger. I worked at Starbucks today. Okay, great. Number two, band. I had good band rehearsal today. Great. Now we're talking. And we're using these verbal prompts and these cues that get language going.
Yeah. Was that something that your mom brought from her family as well, or was she kind of figuring out on the fly because of such a big family?
I think she was figuring out on the fly.
Yeah.
Because this was a zoo. Dinner was a zoo. I'll never forget that Lazy Susan. It was the greatest thing ever, but you couldn't touch it for seconds until you cleared your plate and contributed to the meal by telling a story.
Where do you fall in the
oldest male? So it goes Pam, okay. John, Helen, Jerry, Mark.
So if you were the first person to move out, then you didn't experience the sort of like I was second to youngest, so I sort of watched it whittle down as people moved off and went to. I mean, I was not that person, but it's interesting that you only experienced the big family group because you were the oldest, so you would be the first one to thin it out. I would assume.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what you knew. That's absolutely what you knew.
Yes, and a lot of their parental, when they were cutting their teeth on being parents, the trial and error puppy was me.
Sure, sure. What were the, you said you were a jock. What sports did you play?
Absolutely anything and everything.
Yeah.
I was really fast. So track, football, baseball, basketball, anything. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
We weren't, because my mother taught school, and so she wasn't home till 4 or 5, we weren't allowed in the house when we moved out to Jersey. We weren't allowed in the house until dinner.
Mm.
And so it never occurred to any of us to go to the house.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was hungry, like as you were suggesting, but you weren't allowed in the house.
Yeah.
My mother, oh my God.
That's probably smart.
So we were one of the first houses in the neighborhood to have a propane grill.
Oh.
And so my mother, who taught at a school called Pingree in Jersey, it's a private school, she'd get home when teachers get home, which is probably 3:45, 4-ish. So she'd take a frozen bird out of the freezer and she'd put it on the counter and let it defrost for 2 hours. And birds don't defrost in 2 hours. It takes a long time. And in the intervening time, right around 5:30 or so, she'd start the grill and it would get super hot. And then she'd take the frozen bird off the counter and stick it on the grill. And of course, the outside cooked, but the inside was largely uncooked. And so when she cut it open, it was black on the outside and purple on the inside.
Oh, no.
So we always called it black and purple chicken.
Great.
And we grew up eating black and purple chicken.
You did? Absolutely. You were eating that raw chicken?
Like you read about. To the bone. Otherwise, you couldn't get seconds.
Thank God nobody got
black and purple,
whatever,
don't, please. With these mutt Irish jeans.
I was going to say, you probably have whatever they call, like they say that terriers have quote unquote garbage stomachs because they can just take like a shark. Just give me a license plate, put it in there. I'll figure out a way to digest
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was like, I remember the first couple of dogs I had in Malibu. I had a friend named Mary who I brought my chocolate labs up to her house. And I always saw her feeding her labs the bones, you know, chicken bones and stuff. And I'm like, Mary, isn't that going to do the blah, blah? And she's like, no. So I started feeding my labs the chicken bones, and they just turned it into confetti.
Yeah.
There was no shards going anywhere.
They were taking care of business. Yeah. Did you guys have pets when you were growing up, too, to add to the cacophony?
No, my mother pulled the plug on that pretty quick.
I think that's probably pretty smart.
We had a dog a couple summers in a row, and they both died. And because I wasn't going to take care of them.
Right.
And the other jackasses weren't going to take care of them.
Right.
And she was taking care of all the jackasses. And so the dogs, one got hit by a car, and the other, I don't know what happened to the other one. I have no idea.
Mystery. One day was there, one day was gone.
No. And no, there were no more dogs.
Yeah.
And my father hated cats. And so I guess the kids aren't going to hear this, but I've now perpetuated a lie since my 12-year-old was born that I am allergic to cats.
You might be.
Well, I'm not. And so
they can develop late.
And so they love cats. And I've just I'm a liar. We lie for a living. And so I just said, no, I get the hives, and then I get the skin, and I can't. And then I start to wheeze, and it's horrible. And so they call my mother Nana, and they call Nana, and they said, is Daddy allergic to cats? She's like, no, he's not. Did he tell you that? He's not allergic. Why would he say that? And they're like, Dad, you busted. You're not allergic. I'm like, yes, I am. Nana doesn't know things.
I know a lot of special effects makeup people. You want me to get hives? I'm going to get hives. I can have hives tomorrow.
I'll throw Mom right under the bus. I'm like, also remember, Nana's nuts. Remember, she's a little cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
You guys aren't going to win this. We're not getting a cat. Not going to win this.
And so now my standard response is, you guys can get as many cats as you want. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When you have your own house.
You have a real cute dog, though.
Yeah, we have yes.
That dog came to set, and
that's a good dog.
I was like, this is a good dog. Good size, smart as hell.
The thing about dogs where we live, and I assume where you live as well, most of Southern California, coyotes.
Yeah.
Coyotes will eat your dog, no problem.
Yeah.
Out where we live, there's a gate on the way to the beach, and on the gate every once in a while, not every once in a while, often you'll see those 8x10 pictures of a missing puppy with a number like you could pull off in college. And you look at it and you're like, oh, you poor bastard. Yeah. Your dog's not missing. He's gone.
Yeah.
Your dog's not missing.
Yeah.
Because the coyotes are so... I saw one this morning. He looked like a wolf from Game of Thrones. I was like, what is that?
They got good eating out there.
Well, yeah, after good. That 5-year drought, now there's tons of food.
Yeah.
You know, after all that rain.
Yeah.
We have all these... I built a baseball field in the lower part of my property when there was a writer's strike, the third year of Scrubs. So right around 2003, 2004, I had nothing to do. And if there is such a thing, you can get in good acting shape where your capacity to look at 2-page single space and just stick it in your brain in 30 minutes, you can get that muscle pretty strong. And it takes, you really start to put on these blinders like a Kentucky Derby thoroughbred where you just, this is what we're doing. And they just kept throwing all this stuff at me, which was great. But then all of a sudden the writer's strike happened, and it was a couple of episodes into season 4 or 5, and I'm wired.
Yeah.
And I couldn't sleep. So I started to excavate the lower part of my property with a pick, a shovel, and a wheelbarrow. And just so I could sleep.
Yeah.
And so now there's this lovely baseball field on the lower part of the property that I called the strike. I named it after when I built it.
Maybe not that lucky for baseball when you strike out, it's bad, but no. It's called the strike.
And so from the master bedroom, you look down at the baseball field. And one morning I saw these young little bunnies out there scurrying around. And so I woke up Kate and Billy Grace, and I brought them to the window. And Kate, who's 8 years old, and she's Edward G. Robinson, she said, you want to know their names? And I said, who? She's the bunnies. I'm like, sure, I'd love to know their names. She goes, because there's a lot of red-tailed hawks here, she goes, dinner, lunch, and snack.
Oh, no.
8 years old.
Oh, my God.
Because the red tails just come down with impunity, and they're just... You're gone.
Oh, God. I probably could have used more of that perspective when I was little, because I definitely was the kid who just couldn't stand to see another... Like, I couldn't stand the predator prey of it all, and...
It's real.
It's very, very real, and... What are you going to do? I mean, it's exciting. At its best, it's exciting. And I hate to say that because I do sort of feel bad for the bunny. But somewhere along the line, I stopped being...
Thousands of
them. Yeah, and I stopped being as horrified and was more fascinated by, like, wait a minute, this is how life works. This is how that hawk eats. This is how, you know, I sort of can't... It's you shouldn't really play favorites with whatever the prey is, even though it's easy to do that because they're damn cute.
And they're the most magnificent things you've ever seen. Oh, God, they're beautiful.
Yeah. We have a lot of owls because I'm right off Griffith
Owls
Park.
Are badasses.
And we have some serious... I mean, we were hiking once, and I mean, really, like the shadow over the moon, because you do not hear anything. It is crazy
and
how silent those
they're
birds are.
They're nocturnal hunters.
Yeah. Yeah. So just having... We had an owl sort of curiously follow us home, just going from tree to tree. And you just, there was, the only way to know it was there is if it hooted. Like,
oh,
it
was
okay with you knowing, but you were not going to catch it flying because it was silent.
Oh, they're badass.
Yeah. So cool. So cool. People who were like, ooh, owl, spooky. You don't want to hear an owl. I'm like, wait, what?
What was the three or four favorite things for you, your takeaways from shooting three seasons of Stan?
Oh, man. Well,
aside from the obvious.
Aside from what's staring me right in the face?
No. Aside from loving the crew and all that, what kind of interesting things really impacted you being on a...
Yeah. Well...
and playing Evie for 3 years.
For me, it really was... I was actually talking about this to a buddy because for me, the gift, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this because you've done so many different roles, especially when it comes to the roles that are vulnerable but also tough or brave, but really they're stupid. You know, they're just reckless. For me, I have had, you know, panic attacks and shit like that. The concern of an experience that in some way minimizes my ability to take care of myself, whether it's heat, whether it's lack of sleep, whether it's a stunt, whatever that is, there's always going to be, or to this point, there has been some voice in me that's like, what if this, and then what? And it kind of catastrophizes. And playing a character like Evie was so wonderful because she wasn't going to not do it. You know what I mean? And that really helped. I mean, it sounds kind of hokey pokey, but...
I buy that.
You know what I mean? Like, for me, there were things I was doing as Evie that I would volunteer to be first for, up to and including going up on that rig when we were going to be floating in the air, that I was like, well, she would do it without even questioning it. Like, she doesn't give herself time to consider the consequences because she can't afford to, because this is the world that she lives in, and this is the job that she's picked in. This is and she's a mom and all this kind of stuff. And she keeps having to help friends in trouble. And so that really gave me permission in a way that, you know, I think that someone might wonder who doesn't act like, oh, what do you get back from your character? And sometimes someone might say like, oh, it's not like that. That's not how acting is for me. Well, that definitely is like that for
me.
You
felt empowered?
I felt empowered.
That's
I felt
astonished.
And coming on the other side of it going like, oh, maybe I don't need Evie next time. Like, I can be Janet and still be brave about this thing.
That's a gift.
And absolutely. So I felt like I became stronger. I became a stronger individual in terms of what I could do, what I could take, what I was or wasn't nervous about, you know? So it was huge. Huge.
That is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really, really grateful for it. And it did make me hungry for more. Like, well, what is the next role going to teach me? What is, you know, what kind of encounter, what kind of experience am I going to have in another job that's going to teach me something new about some other part of the world that I wouldn't necessarily have a relationship to, you know? Is that something that you've experienced in your life as a professional actor? These things that characters have to do them, so then by virtue of that, you have to do them, and then you find out, like, I like that.
I'm not sure about that, but the most wonderful thing that I took away and what I was most proud of with Dana was shepherding the tone of Stan, because it was such a unique tone that we had to change a lot after season one, largely because of you, that you had to start driving, you and Evie had to start driving the story, because it became very screwball. And for people who don't know what screwball means, it's a kind of comedy that was born out of the 40s when the protagonist is always the female. And so it's either Barbara Stanwyck in The Lady Eve or it's Rosalind Russell in His Gal Friday. They're kind of top of the... Lucille Ball becomes Screwball in the 50s or 60s, whenever her show was on. And so even in switching the protagonist to Evie, and making it heavily Evie driving most stories, shepherding the tone with Dana, of keeping the thing grounded in loss, ultimately Stan's loss and him trying to reconcile that at all times, even if it was under, not always up on a billboard,
right?
But even if it was way under, it didn't matter. And he wasn't necessarily good at reconciling loss. And so that's okay too. But shepherding that tone was what felt that that was the most rewarding thing for me. And being peas in a pod with Dana on that, we just, we could, anybody who challenged it was, they kind of buckled because Dana was so articulate. And when the tone, as the tone was realized and it manifest and was presented in this way, it was undeniable. It made the show so unique and is so unique that that was my number one takeaway.
Yeah.
From Stan.
Well, that makes perfect sense. You said something so great when you said that, you know, that at the core, particularly for Stan, is this thing that's happened to him that he may or may not be great at processing. And that really struck me, like, oh, sometimes the most interesting thing to watch a character do is avoid the thing that's right in front of them. You know, like, that's fascinating to see, to not necessarily see someone plow straight through a process, but right. to do everything Stan, they can to shut that off is really interesting.
If he authentically doesn't have that equipment.
Yeah.
Or access to a priest or a rabbi or a shrink who maybe he could bounce this, what he's struggling with, off of. Well, that's out. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
In the arc of this guy's story. And so those are out. What's he going to do about this? And now he's going to time travel? Great. What? That's what you're going to do?
Okay. Good for what ails you. Good for what ails
you. Good for what ails you. And so that, to me, is that's Dana chipping in with trying to get this guy somehow to reconcile this loss.
Yeah, absolutely.
How? Time travel. What?
Through a cabin. It's cool. When were you acting in high school as well? Or it sounds like
no.
You were so busy.
Jock. Total jock.
When did you get bit, so to speak?
I did a ton of radio at Ohio Wesleyan my first year, freshman. Then I transferred to Syracuse, and I went to a bunch of different, they have a communication school there called Newhouse, which is pretty great. And I became clear, I was writing copy for all these upperclassmen, and you weren't allowed to say it. You just had to hand it. And I'm writing draft after draft of copy for sports and news. And I'm like, I want to be a storyteller. So then I transferred, and every time you transferred in college, you were a loser.
Yeah.
And so I transferred 3 years in a row. Then I transferred to NYU to the undergrad circle in the square, which was a zoo. And so I found out that there's NYU grad. And so I transferred there. So I went to four different schools in four different years.
Wow.
And then at NYU grad with Olympia Dukakis and Ron Van Loo and this faculty that was stunning. The mantra became 8 a week, which is a Broadway schedule and an off-Broadway schedule, and it just became about honing and preserving your instrument to be able to do 8 a week. And that, having a toolkit to be able to do 8 a week, whether it was executing that fight at the finale of the first act that you don't get a rib, or that scene where you're going to be elevated and it's more about breathing with your diaphragm than up in your neck where you will lose your voice and you won't do 8 a week, or whatever it takes to be able to do 8 a week that was jammed down our esophagus in a good way. And that is the way I feel, that for some reason I hooked into that. It felt very utilitarian. And 8 a week, that toolkit is when you go to Georgia and it's 110 with 97 degree humidity and lightning's coming. You're going to use your tools to do that scene.
Well, in that regard, you know, it's funny because people, I think it's very easy to distinguish between, you know, being a jock and being a theater nerd. But the physicality that you mentioned, I mean, the fact that you were training to do sports and have that endurance, and you know they're certainly very close to one another in terms of conditioning, and here are the variables that you can control and here are the variables that you can't control, and even just mindset, like what's your relationship to your body, what's your relationship to the commitment you've made to do all of this stuff,
especially
in
a week.
They do work well together. I've never done I would not feel comfortable. I would love to say that, you know, I feel like I have the chops to go do a play. I know I don't. I would have to go to a voice school. I mean, I would have to. I would have to attack it as if it were something that was in many ways just brand new. Because otherwise I would feel like I got hit by a train. There's just no way I wouldn't.
Yeah, but you'd train and you'd know it. You'd crush it.
Well, I appreciate that.
Last time I was lucky enough to do a revival of Glengarry with Al Pacino and Bobby Cannavale about 5 years ago at the Schoenfeld, which is on 44th, right off of 8th. And I trained for it. I set up a theater boot camp in Los Angeles, and I trained for it for 3 months before I went to rehearsal.
Wow, that's great.
It was
great.
A lot of it was fear-driven. Which is fine for me. But I set up a theater boot camp prior to the proper rehearsal, and it yielded profound dividends.
When you arrived at the rehearsal, having kind of had the experience, I assume that you didn't do the training, the 3 months of boot camp with anybody who was in the cast.
Absolutely not.
That was all you. So when you got there, what was that transition like? I don't know really what I'm asking, but the sort of idea of it being like really needing to get this in line, I'm gesturing to myself, and then joining an ensemble. Was there stuff that you thought you would be prepared for that came as a surprise when different personalities entered into it?
What came as a surprise, and I forgot because I hadn't done a play in a second or two, was that in the rehearsal process with an ensemble, the problem or the squeaky wheel gets all the attention, and I wasn't the problem. So my rehearsal process with the ensemble was largely zero. And so there was other variables that were struggling, and that's where the focus went. And so if I hadn't done this theater boot camp in Los Angeles for the 3 months prior to it, it would have been a very different experience, and not as fulfilling and not as liberated. And I was open to exploring. There's something that Jack Benny used to do called a Benny pause. And a Benny pause is, and it takes spine, and it approaches milking something, but it's right before you're milking either a joke or a moment, because you're doing it consciously, and you're taking it off the 1,100 people that are here tonight, and you know the text and they don't, and you know what the next line is and they don't, and you can lean into a moment. It's kind of a Benny pause. And so I felt so empowered by pretty early on after previews, I started exploring Benny pauses. And it was one of the most thrilling things. It's high wire stuff, man.
Yeah.
And you can lean into a moment and you know you got them right here. And then, bang, you just take it. And you have 1,100 people in your back pocket. And it's thrilling.
That's really, really exciting.
It takes spine.
Yeah.
If you're going to milk it, you're going to wreck it.
Right.
But a Benny pause, and this guy's timing, if you go back, well, yeah, I was going to say the Museum of Broadcast, you can Google it. But I used to go to the Museum of Broadcast and watch some of these guys. And this thing that's referred to as a Benny pause is just this little bit of air.
That's awesome.
And it pulls them in.
Yeah.
It's spine tingling stuff.
You know what it reminds me of, although I don't necessarily know that it has the same gravitas, is even just for me in improv, as I've done it over and over again over the years, the idea of silence in improv is very intimidating to the audience because they're worried for you. Like if you get real quiet in improv, or two people come out and start a scene and neither one of them are speaking for some length of time, as they're sort of collecting themselves or they're sort of becoming, you know, unspoken understanding of what may or may not be happening in the scene, not 100% knowing, because if you've got an idea in your head, you don't know if your partner is going to have the same idea. But feel, so what happens a lot of the time in improv is you want to fill that space. You just want to fill it with something.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so that's what it reminds me of for me is getting better at it as I've gotten older and feeling more comfortable just taking my time. Like, we got this. This is going to scare the shit out of them. And then we're going to do something great. And there will be that collective sort of like, oh, it's okay. Oh, they got this. I'm not sitting on the edge of my seat going, are you about to just flop because you're frozen for some reason?
I would think in improv, or this is a question, do you start to trespass into taking the audience out of it if they're worried about the two people up there?
I think
There are things that you have to, that I feel like I've had to disconnect from with improv, and one of them is like wanting the laugh. And so it's absolutely symbiotic, and your show absolutely depends on, you know, the sort of energy of the audience and what they're getting from it. But I think that the dependence on the audience for some comedians becomes almost like in golf, like a handicap. Like, well, you're coming to the table really relying on them to do X, Y, Z, and if it doesn't happen, you see it happen all the time with comedians. They blow up their audiences. Like, they get mad at them. Like, that was a great joke. What do you, you know, or they sort of retreat into themselves. And I don't do stand-up, and I could not do stand-up. So hats off to people like Dana who, you know, just live in that space so comfortably.
It looks impossible.
It looks impossible.
When it's good.
Yeah. But so I think there is kind of, it's an interesting question, because there is sort of a simultaneous, like, we're all having this ephemeral experience together, and it truly will never be repeated because we're making shit up and we'll never remember even what we said by the end. But there's also has to be a little bit of a separation that's like, I can't care that much about how you feel in this moment, or I'm going to start thinking about that, and then I will not be able to be spontaneous in the way I need to be.
Right.
So it's definitely a weird merging of those things.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McAvoy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek?
Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about bugs.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too.
Butts.
No.
Will you change your mind?
I want to get into this MASH game that I warned you about.
Okay.
I'm going to start out, because we're talking about performing on the stage. This is sort of an alternate universe. Time doesn't really exist the way it does here. Three roles. If you can think of anything, and this is all very off the top of your head, I realize. So look forward to 2 hours from now going, God damn it, why didn't I say blah, blah, blah.
100%.
We're just living in this improv moment.
Okay.
Three roles. Non-gender specific, whatever, anything's possible in this world that we're creating, that you would love to play on stage, that you've seen happen, or you've always secretly thought, like, I mean, I could do a Lady Macbeth if I was given the opportunity.
I'd love to play Sweeney Todd. Great. For sure. I don't care if it's at a musical theater in Omaha.
A dinner theater, yeah.
I could care less. Sooner or later, I'm going to do Sweeney Todd.
Nice.
I would like to play... Does it have to be on stage, or can it be anywhere?
Let's do anywhere.
I would like to somehow find a father in an integrated family with a child who has special needs, like Minnie just did.
Speechless.
With her show.
Yeah.
I'd love to, and they're hard. It's hard to find that. But I'd love to do that, so we'll call it Special Needs Dad.
Great.
And... I'd love to play a woman like Robin did with Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah.
That just, not a revival of Mrs. Doubtfire,
right. But something akin to.
I'd love to play a gender bending person.
I was obsessed with the movie Tootsie growing up, and
the Broadway musical
very much.
Smash.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I got to see it. But that was a real lesson for me, and just in even that moment where, you know, he's just him and he's back, and everyone knows that he was, you know, they feel betrayed, and that moment where Jessica Lange is like, you know, I miss her, like, just from the bottom of her heart, I genuinely miss that woman. She's still real to me. You know, she doesn't say this, but clearly she's still this real thing to her that she can't let go of. And then Dustin Hoffman says, you know, she misses you too. And it's just like, oh, what a perfect moment.
It's pretty good. Always get you.
Yeah. I gotta work on my Dustin Hoffman. Okay, great. Let's do three places in the world. Imagine getting there is no object that you would like to have a vacation home.
Siena in Italy. In Tuscany. Somewhere high up in Colorado. Above Boulder somewhere, and in Dublin.
Nice. Okay. Three places and times in history. You're in a safety bubble, so whatever you're observing is not going to get you. You're not going to get the croup or be shot. But three, and it could be a very specific moment, or it could be sort of an era that you get the chance to see firsthand.
Since I'm just a student and not necessarily a parishioner, I would love to have been able to hang around this person named Jesus.
Yeah, right?
I'd love to see what this person's thing was.
Agreed.
I don't want to misrepresent that I'm a Bible beating. I just would like to see who this guy was.
100%. Strip it all down and just see this person.
All these people.
Absolutely.
I would love to have seen who and what Napoleon was. Because he impacted a generation. And I would have liked to party with Teddy Roosevelt.
Nice. Teddy R. Fantastic. Okay, let's do three. This is sort of three worlds that you can jump into and just engage with the characters. It could be a film. It could be a book. You're not reliving the plot. It's just somebody has established this world that that does something for you for whatever reason.
Let's see. I would love to have been in Rome during Caligula. Everybody was just going bananas.
It's true. That reminds me of, like, I wish I could experience observing mass hysteria about something. Like, the dancing plague. I would love to be there physically and be like, am I going to get this? Am I going to suddenly feel like I can't stop dancing just because the collective conscious has decided that we all are inflicted with something that makes us dance? That's crazy. How fascinating.
I would love to have been with Kamehameha when he was inventing what Hawaiian culture would ultimately be. And third, I would like to have been with Oppenheimer at Los Alamos to see something that impacted us maybe more than anything else in
Absolutely.
The history of mankind.
Absolutely. All right, I'm taking it light. Three foods or beverages, whatever, three substances that in this reality, for whatever reason, it's either, you know, ecologically you feel guilty about it, or high in calories doesn't make you feel great, or have an allergy to, or even just a rare food that you can't just have at the snap of your fingers because you had it once in Japan. This is in this world, you can have as much as you want of whatever this thing is with zero negative ramifications to anyone or anything.
I would love, because of a health thing, I had to stop eating meat 2 years ago. I would love to be able to eat steak without any issues.
Great.
I'd love to have as much dairy as I please.
Yep.
I just can't.
Yep.
And I'd love to be impervious to sugar.
Great.
And I can't eat any of those three things.
My friend.
And I want to.
I know. It's like the urge, the desire has not disappeared. The desire is still there. Well, listen, this could be your ticket to it right here. This fictitious alternate universe. You can know the alternate universe you might be living large. And then you can deeply resent him.
Caesar and Caligula.
Exactly. Good luck. Okay, next category. Three people from... Again, I'm really leaning up because I know you're a history buff, but three people from history that you sort of have a bat phone to. It's like this person is your buddy, but also your mentor, and somehow you can transcend through time over the phone and call this person, or, you know, just ask them questions about stuff. I know we've kind of covered some of this, but it could also be a character from a book or a movie, but somebody who you can kind of drop into your world and engage with and learn from.
I would love to have a direct connection with Vincent van Gogh to maybe share in his madness or provide a shoulder to him.
Yeah.
But that might wreck his art. I would love to be in Spain with Hemingway during the Spanish Revolution, and or he'd be able to talk to him about it as a correspondent, which is what he was.
Yeah.
And I would love to have a phone call with Amelia Earhart on her final trip to see what the heck was going on. If it was all that, or if it was just a mistake, or see what happened to this incredible woman.
Yeah. Listen, speaking of incredible women, I should have warned you that the MASH game usually involves a fictitious romance. Could be a flimsy thing, could be a life partner. You know I adore Nicole. I always feel terrible. Sometimes people are like, oh, this is no problem. I got some crushes. And sometimes people are like, oh, I don't want to. But do you have either, again, figures in history or female characters from films, or you used to have mostly a crush films on Angela Lansbury? So, yeah, so these are characters.
Rita Hayworth.
Great, 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 great.
In Gilda. That's just a natch.
Great.
Claudia Cardinale in The Professionals. And this is, I don't know why I find her attractive, because I'm pretty sure she wasn't, but Barbara Stanwyck is just crushes me.
Yeah.
I just think she's the biggest badass of all time.
Love it. Love, love, love. Okay. And this last one, I mean, now we're treading into like beauty pageant territory. So it doesn't have to be like, I visualize world peace. But are there elements, what are elements that exist in the world? Maybe it's not something as vast as the cure for cancer, or maybe it is. But three things that, you know, you would love to see resolved or people educated to by the end of your lifetime. Like, we figured this out, or we understand this, or we stopped fucking fighting and having this happen here, or, you know what I mean, we discovered the this.
I'd love to see us get a clue about Alzheimer's.
Yep.
We already have erectile dysfunction figured out, so that's so that
save it.
We're good there. So that'd be redundant.
Sure.
I'd like to figure out another platform for Stan.
Great.
Obsessed much, John?
Listen, you think I'm going to argue with that one? Forget it.
And the third would be when the Segways came out, those tilted two-wheel vehicles that go around, there was all these rumors before it came out, because it was coming from Silicon Valley and all the biggest brains in the room were working on this thing.
Yeah.
And the reveal was going to be world-changing. And it came out and it was the fucking Segway. I thought it was going to be a jetpack.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I'd like a jetpack.
Fantastic. Great answer. Okay, pick a number between 1 and 7.
3.
Great. All right. I'm going to pause this, good, do some very quick, I can't even call it math. I will come back with your 100% guaranteed fictitious alternate universe MASH future. All right, listen, I got to get to something straight away. Was there a particular role that Barbara Stanwyck played as a specific character that you were especially taken by? Okay, so that's who you end up with. I'm going to tear off that Band-Aid, because I'm not sure actual Barbara Stanwyck, she may or may not have been into dudes.
She's so smoking in the Lady Eve.
Well, the Lady Eve, the character, has now come to life and is your romantic partner.
The Lady Eve is a snake.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
But Hank Fonda is just, he can't even, she's just so amazing.
Yeah.
He can't even handle it.
All right. So I started off with that because I wanted to just establish that right away, because there was a difference between the actress and the character. I want to let you know that you will be absolutely playing Sweeney Todd. Yes. It's right here in the cards. When you have finished, maybe when you wrap that, you're ready for a little vacation at your house in Siena. I know for sure that there are, you know, it's easy to get to, but if you want to kind of take the most fun way of getting there, rest assured you got a jetpack. We got jetpacks, guys.
Best afternoon of my life.
Jetpacks. Speaking of flying through the air, you also have the amazing opportunity to speak to Ms. Amelia Earhart on the day.
How about
her biggest, it's all kind of tying together here. Amelia Earhart. Not only that, but you can have the experience of sort of being side by side with Oppenheimer in Los Alamos.
Wow.
And that seminal kind of goosebumps moments.
Reinvents mankind.
And then, listen, you got to loosen up a little bit after all that heavy. You're going to party with Teddy Roosevelt.
That's going to be fun.
With unlimited amounts of sugar.
Sugar's what I get.
That's a nice broad thing. Basically, everything has sugar. You could go nuts.
Right.
You're going to get that delicious sugar rush. Nothing bad's ever going to happen. You should be partying with Teddy R.
Yes.
And that, my friend, is your MASH future.
Wow.
Well played, my friend. Well played indeed.
That's Johnny, a hell of a future.
This has been so fun. I'm so glad that we had a reason to catch up because we live very far away from each other. So we found a wonderful halfway mark.
I'm sure we could only do this for another 10 hours.
I know. I looked at the clock and was like, yeah, that felt like 15 minutes. I'm crazy about you. I hope we get a chance to do stuff together. And for the rest of you. Oh, my God. I almost forgot this. I forgot. When I do my Boys of Summer episodes, I ask them to, I really should have warned you about this one, sing or hum or songs or speak sing a little bit of Don Henley's Boys of Summer. It's a tradition.
After the boys have summer have gone.
Talk to you guys next time on the podcast. The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.